Associate Director of the Center here at BYU Law School. We're grateful for your attention this morning and pleased to welcome three distinguished panelists at this third plenary session. We have on our panel Alberto Patiño Reyes, who is a professor of law and religion at the University Iberoamericana in Santa Fe in the city of Mexico. We also have with us my associate, Professor Brett G. Scharfs, who is Associate Dean of the J. Reuben Clark Law School, and the Francis R. Kirkham Professor of Law, as well as being Associate Director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies here at BYU. We finally have with us Professor Joseph E. David, Professor of Law and Religion at University of Oxford, Wolfson College, and also from the Sapir Academic College in Israel. We will go in the order of first Professor Patiño, then Professor David, and finally Professor Scharfs. Thank you.
I apologize. I'm going to speak in Spanish. I know there are excellent interpreters. I'm sorry.
I feel honored to be here. I am grateful to Professor Durkheim and Doxy and all the staff from this international center. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I will present a few items from the perspective of a professor of religious liberty regarding laicity in America, in Latin America. My presentation has been divided in three separate arguments. The first argument is a historical argument to speak of the state. Almost in every Latin American country, upon coming to their independence from Spain, Portugal, and some from France, from the second decade of the 19th century, they all registered conflicts between liberals and conservatives for the power which during centuries the monarchy had upon the Catholic Church. Spanish poet Miguel Muno, in his novel, said, "Peace during war," and said that was a time of revolts between realists and constitutionalists, between apostolics and masons, end quote. Only in Mexico and Colombia, it occurred that they resolved their differences killing each other rather than listening to each other regarding the issues and the roles that the governors needed to carry out in the Catholic Church then, which was the official church. That violence for the control of the Catholic Church through the patronage motivated that my country, both liberals with President Juarez at the head and following the conservatives with Emperor Maximiliano, they both searched with interest a agreement to fix the issues with the Catholic Church. Similarly, an attitude was shown by governors of the new Latin American republics. Upon a lack of response from the host to resolve these issues from the old territories, both Spanish and Lusitans in America, and in front of the violence that was displayed by the Catholic Church in Mexico, the Conservative Party disappeared. In Colombia, the Conservative Party triumphed. In my country, after a civil war in 1857 and 1860, the liberals accomplished the separation from the state and between the state and the church, and they imposed liberalism as the only school of thought. And it was not until 1873 when the separation principle in the church was established in the Constitution, and it was stipulated 16 years before. In the Constitution of 1917, laicity was implemented in regards to education that was given by the state. Therefore, Mexico was converted into a modern country before the end of the 19th century. With a violent radical process between both institutions, where the liberals were the ones who won. In the different states in America, the First Amendment of 1971 was the remedy to guarantee the separation from the church. Meanwhile, their southern neighbors were carrying out battles to achieve the separation between church and state. Now, what happened in the rest of the countries, in the Latin American countries? Something similar occurred with Mexico in relation to this separation. In the last quarter of the 19th century, all Latin American countries were influenced by liberal ideologies. Some countries carried out a formal separation between the state and the church. For instance, the first country that accomplished this separation between both institutions was Colombia in 1853. Although in 1876, there was a war between liberals and conservatives, and they established yet again a confessional state in Colombia in the Constitution of 1876, which constitution would be vigent until the 5 years later. Peru was the only country in Latin America that was recognized expressly, that was given the right of patronage, meaning that the confessionality of the state was kept until 1980. In other countries, the separation of the state and the church was a little more harmonious, meaning if there was a war, I mean Brazil, 1890, Panama, 1904, Ecuador, 1906, Uruguay, 1917, Honduras, 1924, Chile, 1925, Cuba, 1940. In some other nations, particularly in Central America and South America, some kept unilaterally their patronage, and they imposed from their positions liberal reforms, which was the case in Venezuela, Guatemala, Costa Rica, Paraguay, and Argentina. This last country maintained their patronage until 1966. An interesting case was the Oriental Republic of Uruguay, where confessionality was established in the state in 1930. Although with exercise, liberty of exercise with regards to Catholic practices, and because of the rights of practice, association, and equality. In Uruguay, there was a process of secularism registered similar to the one in Mexico from 1968, which culminated with the separation of the state and the church in the Constitution of 1917. This historical argument concludes that the Catholic confessionality of the state and the intolerance to other religions different to Catholicism were opposed in almost every single Latin American country as soon as they achieved their independence, following the idea of Christianity, the narrow union between the throne and the union represented in the church, and it was rooted in Spain. This idea of Christianity was defeated And I'm arguing in favor of the neutrality of the state and the religious liberty of the citizens. A laic state is one that is not identified with one specific church, maintaining a neutral position against the religious phenomenon. The principle of laicity, although I prefer to say neutrality, in the relationships between states and religious groups, is adapted in general by all Occidental countries. Even when the forms in which the laicity is understood and practiced may differ. Denominations that are received are varied. We speak of a model of separation between state and church, a model of confessionality, or a French model of laicity of the state. I am of the opinion that for the future, the challenge that many Latin American countries face is to defeat the remains of the model of the Catholic's style, which is more closely related to Christianity, which operated over three centuries, and in some countries it continued to an extent until the end of last century. To achieve this, I believe it is needed that the laic state may be concreted. I mean a model where the rights of minorities are recognized, and furthermore, where the convictions of religious groups are not excuses to recognize or not recognize the rights of individuals. I mean a political system that is inclusive, where all persons can express freely their faith, and in other words, a laic state is a synonym of religious freedom. The resistance to overcome the old school religious beliefs in Latin America, for instance, Costa Rica, and their Article 75th of their constitution, it mentions that the Catholic Church is the state religion, which contributes to its maintenance without impeding the free exercise in the Republic of other beliefs that are not opposed to the morals or to good customs. Well, nobody questions that Costa Rica does not accept freedom of religion. Another example is Peru. They have a good law of religious freedom with some issues in its reglementations, but it is still obvious in front of all of the civil authorities. I speak of, to give you an example, the procession of the Sir of the Master of the Miracles, in which every year the President of the Republic does a salutation to this image of the God of the Miracles. So I ask if this infringes the inclusion of minorities because of their rituality, the ritual of a cult of a majoritarian church. In favor of the state neutrality, I could continue to say many things, but I will quickly only refer to what happens in my country. In my country, there are also still remains of a confessional Catholic state. For example, I would like to point out the Confession to the Sacred Heart and the Virgin Mary, which was done by Cesar Duarte, governor of the state of Chihuahua, just in April 2013. In some other countries, more recently, in September 18th, the socialist president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet, went to the Santiago Cathedral to a Te Deum with the motives of another anniversary of the independence of that country. It seems as though to maintain the temptation of the remains, constitutional remains, it's still present in the reality of Latin America. So I ask myself if that stand of civil authorities favors religious liberty, if it is inclusive of minorities. In my opinion, it violates the autonomy of the state and the churches, because the point is not freedom, religious freedom of the governor or the person, but rather to act as though he was a minister, to publicly conduct a ritual manifestation that does not compete with him. And in second term, the participation of Ms. Bachelet in the rituality, which is proper of a majoritarian church, which is the Catholic Church, which she attended as the Chilean president. And I believe it seems to me as though it excludes the plurality of religions of such a modern country such as Chile. My last argument to defend laicity against laicism. The neutral state and laicity represent two antagonistic modes of understanding separation between state and church. Laicism stems from an ideology. Laicism is characterized by the indifference, but and not for hostility against religious phenomenon. In this sense, and contrary to the neutral state, laicism is exclusive, and it can become intolerant to the degree of pretending the elimination of expressions of faith, of persons or groups that interact in a society, to the degree of reducing such expression to only individual conscience. In one extreme, laicism implies the complete eradication of religious freedom in social life. For instance, prohibiting religious symbols in public spaces when they impose and promote laicism in public schools. And similarly, as they how they impose a religious confession in the state. They conceive as a public space as a free space, a space free from any religious reference. Therefore, in Latin America, laicism represents a way of being a confessional state. It affirms that a laic state enjoys freedoms and rights only derived from the consensus. It sustains that politics refers to the citizens and not to the believers, meaning it excludes. Laicism as an ideology in Latin America is exclusive. In the Latin American context, laicism has been utilized as a reason for those groups who support the recognition of different inclinations in sexual orientation, abortion, same-sex marriages, legalization of consumption of certain drugs such as marijuana, among other topics. A couple examples: July of 2010, Argentina became the first country in Latin America to establish access to enter into marriage notwithstanding sexual orientation, such as the adoption of minors from parents of the same gender. This event motivated a breaking with Cristina Fernandez, Argentina's president. We need to remember that in 2005, President Finado Kirchner had responded with the announcement of not attending this Te Deum, which was something positive, because since they didn't attend, this custom came to an end. Also in my country, we have registered certain issues derived from the approbation of same-sex marriage in Mexico City. And the answer was to establish a laic republic with the intention of silencing the cult ministers, meaning the members of the Catholic hierarchy, as they were subject to the approbation of this legislation. I conclude, in Latin America, It's unthinkable to return to a situation of Catholic confessionality. Such situation is perceived as something that is dangerous even for the Catholic Church. Religious plurality is a reality in Latin America. Therefore, confessionality in the state and the intolerance of other beliefs that are different from Catholic that were imposed in almost every single Latin American country once they achieved their independence has been left behind. It's even contrary to its own declaration, Dignitatis Humana, from the Vatican. Now, looking to the future, that Latin American states to abandon all pretense of secular confessional, a denominational without God, to really be secular state. Therefore, the neutrality of the state can be seen as a means to religious freedom and not as an end. I believe that the future of secularism in Latin America has to make a distinction between neutral or secular, that is inclusive, state and guarantor of religious freedom, and secularism, which is an exclusionary ideology. And lastly, the future of secularism in Latin America finds its rationale in the existing religious plurality and unthinkable and identify where the concept of a national state with the Catholic concept. Today, religious diversity is a reality, and pretend to ignore it does little to religious freedom, which is the right, most important right, and another reason for a secular state that guarantees religious freedom. Human rights and the human rights has to receive a more important role to ensure the rights of religious minorities, but also to denounce and condemn the exclusion of religion in the public space, which is looking for promoters of secularism in our region in Latin America. Thank you very much.
I'd like to make the distinction between post-secularism
personal identity, which I will touch touch a bit forward. But I'd like to say that I'd like to pay attention to the centrality of the epistemological aspect. Now, there are various articulations to the connection between the notion of the secular and secularism. I guess we will hear some new stuff ahead in the next talk. But traditionally, I think the first one who made the connection was Max Weber, when he said that secularism is basically an epistemological attitude, where he defined secularization as a new epistemology which is directed towards the human being and rationality, as against the old epistemology, which was religious and directed towards God. But this is not the only articulation to the connection between the secular and secularism. We can find other articulations, mainly made by different point of view, different ideologies. The one which is quite famous, which I think could attribute fairly to both contemporary thinkers, Charles Taylor and John Rawls, the late John Rawls, is the one that is concentrated on the idea of neutrality. The secular denotes a mode of knowing which is neutral with respect to the religious commitments or visions of the good, and those open to common to all. The state, emerging out of the conflict of religious wars, find in the secular a kind of lowest common denominator, and those establishes a political ethic independent of religious conventions altogether. Now, as we know that the secularization thesis, which actually is sometimes told as a narrative, as a project, as a paradigm, a historical one, a sociological one, a political one, or a philosophical one, was refuted or criticized in various levels. But I think, as José Casanova made it clear, the three elements, the three basic elements of the secularization thesis are the following. The first one is the increasing structural differentiation, which includes, of course, the differentiation between religion and politics, the privatization of religion, and the decline of the belief in commitments and institutions. Now, kind of vicious circle or tautology. But more than that, about the categories of the secular and the religion, he's making the following argument. He's saying that the secular is not a continuous way of the religious. It is not a simple break from it, but rather the secular is a concept that brings together certain behaviors, knowledge, and sensibilities in the modern life. Moreover, he argues that since the secular and secularization is deeply rooted within the perception of modernity, we cannot really face and observe the concept of secularity, the secular secularization, directly, but only through what he calls, following Nietzsche, the genealogical search, namely tracing its origins and tracing its traces during the history. The secularization thesis, from his perspective, is actually inventing the concept of religion at all, to the same extent that it invents the concept of the secular. The religious and the secular, he would argue, are mutually dependent on each other, and in fact, they both constitute each other. Now, if we move to Israel, I'd like to pay attention to two, I think, significant trends that one could trace and could think about them as the trends that might draw the future of secularization. The first one, I would argue, it's some kind of post-secularization, which in many ways it's also counter-secularization. It's a counter-reaction to secularization, and it's mainly being apparent by the fact that many domains in life which were initially secularized, namely neutral and pure from religion, are now being sacralized again. Being sacralized means that religious meanings are ascribed to them. So if beforehand history, for example, was more or less a national issue, a neutral issue, now there's much more emphasis on history as a sacra historia, religious history. To the same extent, politics, memory, social and cultural institutions and values. The trend that I'm pointing on is making them or ascribing to them or approaching them as sacred much more than ever before. In Israel, it appears to be that there is much more appearances and emphasis on religion and religion affairs in the public sphere and the media, much more legitimization for religious demands on the public sphere. But I think much more budgets actually, which are endowed to religious institutions and facilities. But I think that at the basis of all this, there is also some epistemological shift. And as I said, it's about sacralizing reality, namely viewing reality through religious lens much more than ever before. And I'd like to bring one example to this from the very recent examples, actually, from the past summer, which, as many of you know, both societies, the Israelis and the Palestinians, drew themselves into political conflict. And one of the examples is brought from the letter that one of the Israeli commanders wrote to his soldiers before getting into combat, trying to encourage them and to encourage their morale. This was a famous one, there was a big debate on it, but this is actually the accurate translation from part of it, so I'd like to read it with you. Only the emphasized lines. History has chosen us to be sharp edge of the bayonet of fighting the terrorist enemy from Gaza, which curse soldiers who hold different religious point of view on the political conflict, on the rule of God in human conflict on earth. Nevertheless, he expresses, it was not an official stance, but nevertheless, he was an official and he expressed his views, and this was in many ways legitimized by all levels. Now, the second trend which I'd like to point into is, I think, really connected to Talal Assad's criticism, and that is Israel in many ways is a case study for the encounter of the Western European conscious, including the distinction between the secular and the religion, and also the Oriental one. Only because Israel is a mixed society from Jews immigrating from Western countries and from Muslim countries or Arab countries as well. So in Israel, actually, many sociologists traces the fact that the categories of the secular and the religious were not fully accepted in the public discourse. There is another category, a third category, which might also pay us attention to what I called behind secularism. And that is the category of traditionalist. Now, I'd like to just bring you one piece of data, that 20% of the Israelis define themselves as religious, either Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox. The remaining define themselves as secular. But if you ask them about the third category, so more than a third of the Israeli Jews commonly choose the label traditionalist, or in Hebrew, masorti, which comes from the word masoret, namely tradition, when they ask to categorize their Jewish identity. And here we face also that the secularization and religious features are not only a matter of ideology, history, or political stances, but also a matter of personal identity. Now, in that regard, I think that there is a very interesting way to look at it. If we look at medieval writings, or medieval thinkers, when they approached the idea of tradition, for them, tradition was a matter of authority. When they argued whether they are rationalist or traditionalist, for them, tradition was a source of knowledge and authorized knowledge. Nowadays, when people talk about their association with tradition, tradition for them is a source of identity and meaning, a way to organize the meaning in their life, a way to create a dialogue with their past and create their ways to the future. I'll stop right here. Thank you.
So much to be here because this is my home, but to be with you and to welcome you as visitors to our home. I'm really thankful for the chance I've had to be on this panel with Professor Reyes and Professor Joseph David. The distinction that Professor Reyes was drawing between laicity and laicism is almost exactly the distinction that I'm hoping to emphasize today. And I think it also fits in quite interesting ways with the distinction that Joseph David was making between post-secularism and beyond secularism. A number of scholars, including myself, have argued that there are two distinctly different conceptions of the concept of the secular. On the one hand, secularism, which we describe as a comprehensive normative ideology, and on the other hand, secularity, which we describe as a more modest framework for pluralism. This distinction, however, remains in need of clarification. characteristics or features of this distinction between secularism and secularity, and to do this by focusing on seven different disciplinary perspectives on the meaning of the idea of the secular. Now, as a preliminary matter, it's interesting to note that the idea of the secular is a relational concept. It is almost always defined in relation to religion. And in a way, this is ironic, since in its earliest incarnation, the idea of the secular was understood as a subcategory of religious interests. In the Middle Ages, secular priestly vocations, which focused on service in the world, were contrasted with monastic priestly vocations, which focused on prayer and other worldly directed devotion. Thus, the secular was one dimension of the church's work in the temporal world and was contrasted with another dimension of the church's work focused on eternity. But the meaning of words change. And today, the secular is almost always defined in opposition to religion, with the contrast between the secular and the religious often cast as a kind of zero-sum game. And so, if nothing else, this serves as a reminder to us that the meaning of even important concepts can undergo dramatic transformations. The basic distinction between secularism and secularity, as I'm describing it, is rather easy to sketch. Secularism, on the one hand, we see as something of a substantive normative ideology, which seeks affirmatively to promote a secular order. Secularity, on the other hand, is a framework for pluralism. Secularism seeks to overcome religion, whereas secularity would seek to avoid state identification with any particular religion or ideology, including secularism itself. This is what I think Professor Reyes meant when he talked about the national religion of secularism. Normatively and theoretically, secularism is quite a thick and ambitious project, whereas secularity, in contrast, embraces a more thin conception of the political good, adopting Rawls's terminology. Secularism itself becomes a doctrine of constitutional law, which is used to interpret the meaning of important rights, such as freedom, equality, and human dignity. Whereas secularity will have a more modest ambition to create what we might call, in Melbourne University Law Dean Carolyn Evans' words, constitutional space, a place of safety where people can live out their own thick conceptions of the good, but the state is not itself trying to impose a particular conception of the good, be it religious or non-religious. Secularism, to use Isaiah Berlin's terminology, would emphasize positive freedom. It is trying to help people be what the state views them as capable of being, whereas secularity might be more inclined to emphasize negative freedom, viewing the state as a threat rather than necessarily a enhancer of freedom. I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but secularism deep down believes in the commensurability of value, and so it engages in a process and a project of maximization. Secularity, on the other hand, would more likely view values as being plural and incommensurable, and therefore would be suspicious of any project of maximization, including maximizing the value of the secular. Earlier yesterday, we heard a distinction between hard secularism and soft secularism, and I think this also maps quite closely to what I'm describing as secularism on the one hand and secularity on the other. Just as a matter of setting the stage, I think that my preference for secularity righteous, what I call itties as opposed to isms. And so in general, I am drawn to liberality more than to liberalism, to liberty more than to libertarianism, to equality more than egalitarianism, to the value of humanity rather than to the ideology of humanism, to universality rather than universalism, and to community rather than to communism. Now, in making these distinctions, I don't think I'm engaging in just a linguistic game. I think there's something quite important in the attitude and the work that is done by itties as opposed to isms. And I think this difference is what we might call conceptual overload. When we take a good idea and expect too much of that idea, this is a little bit like taking a backpack and filling it with something good, let's call it water for the journey, but we load our backpack with so much of that good thing that we can no longer make the journey at all. And it turns out that we may need a variety of good things in our backpack. In addition to water, we may need food, we may need shelter, we may need a tent, we may need something to purify water so that we can encounter water along our journey and make it potable. I think there's a deep sort of philosophical tension between approaches that want to take an idea and create a comprehensive theory out of it and less ambitious projects which, even though valuing the idea, and I do value the idea of the secular, do not want to expect that idea to do all of the conceptual work that we need, for example, to organize a political society. Well, here, of course, I'm only going to be able to sketch in the very briefest way this distinction that I see manifest itself in various types of academic discourse. What I'd like to do is discuss from the perspective of history, politics, social science, law, philosophy, metaphysics, and epistemology, a division within these discourses that basically tracks and parallels this distinction between secularity and secularism. I apologize for the very sketched and brief character of this introduction. I'm not so much trying to make a conclusive argument as identifying patterns that would themselves be subject to greater elucidation in the future. What about the historical perspective? Well, we've already heard quite a lot about this. From the point of view of secularism, history is a story of the progressive decline of religion, what Professor David identified as the secularization thesis. Here, religion is viewed as growing increasingly obsolete. It may be viewed as prejudice, superstition, or intolerance. It might even be viewed as fanatical or pre-modern. We tend to see conflicts between Enlightenment values on the one hand and religious values on the other hand. And this historical story can become quite strident in its anti-religious character, and indeed can become susceptible to a type of secular fundamentalism. One thing that I think is interesting about this is that it is at once triumphalist, trumpeting the conquest of religion by reason, but on the other hand, it can be quite defensive in saying we must not allow religion any space at all. And so there's this sort of interesting dynamic between the triumphal and the defensive character of this historical story. Secularity, in contrast, tells a different historical story. It tends to focus on a story of increased religious diversity, increased pluralism, and to find stories and strategies for living together in spite of or in light of our differences. What about a political perspective? From a political perspective, secularism tends to talk a lot about institutions institutional spheres, the sphere of the church on the one hand and the sphere of the state on the other hand. And there is a lot of effort put into differentializing the appropriate sphere of each. There can be disdain for the power of the clergy, especially when it encroaches into the secular sphere, and an effort to control, limit, or cabin religious influence. Secularity, on the other hand, will view religion not so much in relation to the state, but in relation to society. And it will emphasize things like civil society and the role of religion in civil society and as a civil society institution. Secularism, political secularism, can be dismissive or disdainful of religious believers, characterizing them as backwards or unsophisticated. At best, they may be objects of toleration. Secularity, on the other hand, will be more comfortable with confident and sophisticated religiosity and will move from mere toleration to respect of the thick, complex, and interesting ways that different religious traditions work their way into the world and work themselves out in the world. The secular conception of the state, from the point of view of secularism, really traces itself to the Treaty of Westphalia. When states were not expected to be secular, we had confessional states, but the relationships between states were intended to be based upon secular considerations. Interestingly, it's the Human Rights Project, the post-World War II project begun with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that reinserts individuals back into international law. And with that insertion of individuals into international law, this Westphalian idea of the states as being entirely secular comes under pressure. From a social perspective, secularism sees the privatization of religion. One of the side effects of this is that as a social welfare state grows, the area of private life is shrunk. And so religion may find itself pushed into an ever smaller corner. Secularity, on the other hand, might emphasize civil religion, folk religion, what Robert Bella has called the institutionalized collection of the sacred beliefs of a nation. And so, for example, secularity would seek common ground through our religion, as the Declaration of Independence does in invoking nature's God rather than a Christian or sectarian God. And it would believe that there's a possibility of a public religion that is not overtly sectarian, that strives to be inclusive and pluralistic. What about a legal perspective? Well, in the United States, the primary distinction or debate over the meaning of the Establishment Clause is between separationists, which basically track the secularism attitude, and accommodation. And this plays itself out in free exercise as well as establishment contexts. From a philosophical perspective, secularism is going to be very drawn to the idea of public reason. And there's a powerful appeal to the idea of public reason. This is the idea that when we communicate in the public square, we should provide publicly accessible reasons that all rational people can be expected to agree with. But this is presented as more than a principle of etiquette or even a principle of good strategy. It is presented as a moral imperative, saying that religious reasons are morally unacceptable in the political sphere. And this becomes a sort of hard public reason. Secularity, on the other hand, will be more drawn to other models of public discourse, ideas such as sympathetic engagement, ecumenical dialogue, and so forth, and what we might call human rights dialogue. What about a metaphysical perspective? Well, secularism will draw a very strong distinction between the temporal and the eternal, between this world and the other world. The material secularity, as we've seen, might instead, as we saw earlier, be drawn to different notions of religious vocation, different orientations towards the world and heaven, but it might reject the strong duality of the physical and the spiritual. From my religious tradition, for example, there's a Mormon scripture where God declares all things are spiritual unto me, suggesting that this dichotomy between the physical and the spiritual is illusory rather than real. What about an epistemological perspective? Well, secularism will be drawn to the scientific methods, utilizing logic and evidence. This can be reductive. It can result in a type of materialism. Secularity, on the other hand, I think will be more drawn to the idea that there are a variety of types of knowledge and ways of knowing. And so, for example, intuition, emotion, aesthetic experience, religious experience, spiritual discernment, what we learn from acting and observing and receiving compassion, what we learn from loving and being loved, these would be viewed as real, authentic sources of knowledge and understanding rather than just as subcategories of the scientific method. Well, I realize this sketch has been very, very brief and very quick. I don't mean to suggest that these discourses are exactly one stream and there's an alternate stream and that every traveler travels down one river or the other. Rather, I think what these discourses do is they display a different set of lenses through which we view very different categories of knowing. And so these various disciplines, history, I could have talked about psychology, there's a very similar division of the discourse in psychology. To me, it's really interesting that in each of these very different disciplines, disciplines that don't often talk to each other very much, we have these very similar sort of divisions that are very fundamental to thinking about how the world is and how the world works. Thank you very much.
Congratulations, Professor.
I agree with you.
We'd like to thank Professor Alberto Patino Reyes, Professor Joseph David, and Professor Brett Scharfs for their excellent contribution to the discussion of secularity versus secularism and the varieties of secularism, which is the theme of this conference. We have just a little bit of time for questions. If you could make them concise, that would be very helpful. Yes, wait for the microphone, please.
Thank you all for the presentations. I have a question for Professor Scharfs. Actually, a twofold question. The first one is, what's the relationship between secularity and secularism? What are the overlaps? What are the connections?
Catholicity to Catholicism. And I know some Catholics who might say the same thing, but that's too clever in a way, because there's no real term of Mormoninity, but we do speak of Mormonism. And so what I would say is that for our personal thick ideologies, for a Catholic, I think it's good to believe in Catholicism. And for a Mormon, it's okay to believe in Mormonism. But I think we all have to be quite careful with our own isms. And I can have a conversation with you why I think the Mormonism that I believe, which may be different than what some others believe, is defensible. But it does create a challenge for anyone who is devoted to a thick ideology. Now, what I would then add is, I think that's good for persons and communities. I don't think it's good for states. I think that when states get in the business of isms, it's particularly likely to end in what Isaiah Berlin described as breaking an unlimited number of eggs to create such a beautiful omelet. And so I think there's something really important about individual autonomy, individual choice in seeking the isms that we find meaningful and true, but I think it's very problematical, even if those true systems of belief are imposed through state power. I hope that's at least the beginning of an answer to a very deep and important question.
Thank you. We have two questions. We're getting many more now, three or four. Could we ask you please to be as concise as you can be, and we'll ask the panelists also to be concise in view of the time. Let's start with Professor Ture Lindholm.
Thank you. I am Ture Lindholm from Norway, and my background has to do with my question, and I'm asked my question to, actually both to Tatino, Tinio, and Brett, but it's actually Brett's last talk that makes me ask you one question, because I think this distinction between it is and isms is fine. It illustrates a lot. But in a sense, it is not very deep. I mean, it is a wonderful orientation, and it holds amazingly in many cases. But some cases don't hold, I challenge you, namely in human rights. You say that secularism, you associate that with freedom from religion, well, it's going pretty far, but there's something to that, and then human rights is freedom of religion. But as you well know, having discussed with me some years, human right to freedom of religion should be spelled out as freedom of religion or non-religious basic conviction. And I think the translation into freedom of religion or belief is misleading English language translation of obistenia, which was the Russian proposal. And the French say conviction, which is more adequate. So is this does this fit your huge scheme of things that you have? Human rights is not a freedom of religion, exclusive of non-religion, but it's a freedom of having a non-religious worldview based on the idea of equal, inalienable dignity of all human beings.
Well, I'm going to use the privilege of the chair to ask each of the panelists to respond briefly to that question. Professor Scharfs may have something more concrete to say in light of the fact it's a question directly to him, but I would like to hear the perspectives of the others, if that's all right.
When I use the term freedom of religion, I mean freedom of religion, belief, conscience, thought, all of it. And so I'm not trying to privilege religion over other types of conscientious belief in defending a space, a constitutional space, for people to live out their thick views of the good. Now, this may be superficial, but there's a lot written about liberalism, communism, socialism, and a lot of
defenses of them. And so it may be superficial, but there's a lot of harm that has been done in the name of maximizing a good idea. And there's a good idea behind liberalism. There's a good idea behind socialism. There's a good idea behind communism. But when those are maximized as a political, social, legal project, it always ends not in a utopia, but a dystopia. And so that's the itty versus the ism that I am decrying. Now, maybe in the millennial world or the post-millennial world, it will be different. But in our world, that's what I see.
I need the support with interpreters, please.
To answer, in the context of Latin America, I spoke of confessional states, Catholic states in their majority, and of two specific states, which is Mexico and Uruguay, which historically have characterized themselves from a secularism, if I can use the expression, that have been hostile against the religious phenomenon. And for the rest of the countries or the states which have journeyed the way into a democracy lately, I believe that there is a need of a religious plurality, and this makes it necessary that we not only speak of religious freedoms, as Professor has expressed, as he said, speaking of conscience, liberty of conscience, so that no one is obligated to act against their own conscience, or there is a great speaker, Hector Fick Zamudio, in my country. He said that the liberty, religious liberty, was not something very common in Latin America because there was another right that needed to be preserved, which was the right to life. Talking about military dictatorships, oppressive dictatorships that basically ignored human rights. The first right, the right that needed to be kept, was the right to life. For that reason, religious freedom was pushed aside into a corner. And so I consider that once democracy arrived to the majority of the Latin American countries, and as soon as religious plurality came, which leads to a democracy, now we're no longer these states that are majority Catholic. Now there's great plurality. Although it's been said here that Latin America is still considered the least diverse region in the world, I believe that liberty of conscience needs to be protected. And lastly, liberty of consciousness is so important that in my country, this was something that could not be protected. You needed to comply with the law, and it was prohibited to argument motives of consciousness to oversee a legal mandate. I hope this is a valid answer.